I'd like to start by turning to Hebrews chapter 4. Hebrews chapter 4. I think we'll see that this scripture is very familiar. But I'd like to take a slightly different look at it, maybe, or at least start here, and I'm going to end up somewhere else. But we will start here and take a look at the scripture where the writer of Hebrews has been talking about what it means to be a Christian and what the Christian life is about, and encouraging us and describing the interaction of Jesus and where his place is in the plan of God and all those sorts of things. And then he says in chapter 4, verse 16, he starts off by saying, therefore. Therefore means because of everything that came before that. So if we look up above verse 16, we see such things as the fact that a promise remains for, in verse 1, a promise remains for the people of God. In verse 2, we have the idea that we, as opposed to the ancient Israelites, have the gospel combined with faith. They were lacking faith. They had the gospel of their time, and they were lacking faith. But we have it combined with faith. And in verse 15, he tells us also that we have a great high priest. Jesus, of course, is our great high priest, fulfilling the role of a physical priest, and more than fulfilling the role of physical priest. The physical priest was just a mirror or a small part of the role of Jesus Christ. And so he says, because of all of that, verse 16, because of all these things going on up in heaven above us, because of the fact that God is faithful to his promises and we have faith, etc., etc., let us then approach the throne of grace with confidence. Some versions say boldly, so that we may receive mercy and find grace to help us in our time of need. Now, this is not an unfamiliar scripture to us. And I'm sure many of us do this. We also have the example of Hezekiah, for example, who spread the scroll that he received from the Assyrians before God in the temple, and he said, hey, look what they're saying about you. Look what they're saying about the God of Israel. A very direct and very bold approach to God. Jesus tells us in Matthew 21, verse 22, whatever you ask in prayer, you will receive if you have faith. Whatever you ask in prayer. Doesn't sound like there's much of a limit there, does it? And in Mark 11, verse 24, he repeats, therefore I tell you, whatever you ask in prayer, believe that you have received it, and it will be yours. And also in John chapter 15, verse 7, if you abide in me and my words abide in you, ask whatever you wish, and it will be done for you. So we have examples, we have a command, we have encouragement to go boldly before God in prayer. We can enter into that throne room boldly. And we know, as sons and daughters of God, that there is a boldness with which we can come before him, and I'm sure that we do that. As I said, this is not new. We've heard this before. We present our case. We explain our needs and our desires. Maybe it's a new job. Maybe there's a difficult situation at school. Maybe it's an issue of personal improvement. Whatever the issue is, we ask, and we ask boldly. And then we stop, and we fold our arms, and we wait. Then we ask again, and we wait some more. And then as we see the opportunity slipping by, maybe we ask one more time and wait as that opportunity disappears over the horizon. I know I've done this, and maybe I'm not the only one. Maybe some of you have done this as well. So today I want to address a symptom that Christians can fall into. It springs from a righteous source, a righteous desire, that of wanting to follow God, wanting to know what God's desire is for our life. But it takes a turn somewhere between desire and comfort, and it ends up in stagnation. Personal, professional, and possibly even spiritual stagnation. So let me get into this by asking another question. What does God's intervention in a person's life look like? What does God's intervention in your life look like? Sometimes it's incredible. It's obvious. The wind blows all night and the sea parts. Or it's an earthquake that opens the doors of a prison. Or it's a mute person who's been mute all their life being able to speak. Sometimes these things are dramatic. However, sometimes God's interaction in our life looks suspiciously like hard work, like walking across the desert, or conquering a new land, or catering a lunch with too few fishes and not enough bread. Sometimes it looks like hard work. Let me ask another question. Does God give any guidelines for miracles? What do I mean by that? I mean, does the Bible give us any examples of what waiting for a miracle looks like? Do we know what waiting for a miracle looks like? Did Jesus teach his disciples how to wait for miracles? No, obviously one time he did. He told them, go wait till the day of Pentecost, etc. And he told the Israelites at the sea, stand still, I'm going to take care of this for you. Okay, but those are pretty immediate results. Except for Pentecost, they had to wait 50 days. So we understand that. And it is a rather foolish question, but I ask it so that I can juxtapose it with another one. In contrast to the guidelines that God gives about waiting for miracles, which are few, how many times does the Bible give us guidelines on how to live our lives outside of miracles? How to live our lives outside of miracles? I think a few phrases can come to our minds here. Be wise as a serpent and harmless as a dove. That's a lifestyle guideline, a way to live our life. A soft answer turns away wrath. Go to the ant, you sluggard. One of my favorites, if you are a glutton and you're sitting at the king's table, put a knife at your throat. Be careful. The point I hope to illustrate today is that in addition to our prayers and our willingness to submit to God's direction in our lives, God allows us, even expects us, I would say, to make choices in how we live and to make our own way in this world. And it's important that we know how to choose and then act on the choices that we make. It's important for our physical health and well-being, and it can impact our spiritual health as well. And fortunately for us, God gives us many examples in Scripture. The book of Proverbs is full of them, and it's well known. In addition, the book of Nehemiah is a great textbook on leadership for change in difficult times. In fact, a colleague of mine, when I was studying my MBA, was working on his master's thesis on management by Nehemiah, is what it was called. Unfortunately, I never got to see it when it was finished. I never got to read it, and I lost contact with him because I thought that would be an excellent way to look at the book of Nehemiah as a textbook on business management. Anyway, interesting. Jesus' sayings in the gospel also have lots of practical implications too, of course. But I'm not going to focus on those examples today. Instead, I want to go to the book of Joshua. Because Joshua was given this huge task. He had the whole of the promised land before him, and it was his job to lead the conquest of it. That was his job. He was the leader of a squabbling, disorganized group of people, many of whom who had no real reason to cross the Jordan other than their promise to do so. Remember the tribes of Reuben, half the tribe of Manasseh, and Gad, they had all received their inheritance on the east side of the Jordan. So the only reason they were crossing to the other side was because they promised to do so. They left their families, their belongings, all on the other side. Not a huge incentive for them to continue, but they did anyway, to their credit. Anyway, this group of people had repeatedly promised Moses that they would always obey him and God. And yet, just as often, they failed to do so. They were complainers. They were scared. They thought they were hot stuff. On top of that, Joshua had to step into Moses' shoes. The guy who could turn sticks into snakes. How's that for a superpower? The guy who could part the Red Sea, the guy who won battles simply by lifting his arms. He could bring water out of the rock, and he even had a glowing face. He was a legendary character straight out of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, if you will, to put it in our modern terms. So no pressure, Joshua. No pressure at all. You can do this. So if you would, please turn to Joshua chapter 1. The main material for this message is going to be found in the first 18 verses. And for those of you who are quick, you realize there are only 18 verses in the first chapter anyway. So I'm going to read all of this part of the chapter, and I'm going to try to refrain from editorial comments as I do so. And I'd ask you to read along or listen and note what God says, but also take note of what he doesn't say. Joshua 1, verse 1. Now it came about, after the death of Moses, the servant of the Lord, that the Lord spoke to Joshua, the son of Nun, Moses' servant, saying, Moses, my servant, is dead. Now therefore, arise, cross this Jordan, you and all this people, to the land which I'm going to give them to the sons of Israel. Every place on which the sole of your foot treads, I have given it to you, just as I spoke to Moses. From the wilderness and this Lebanon, even as far as the great river, the river Euphrates, all the land of the Hittites, and as far as the great sea toward the setting of the sun will be your territory. No man will be able to stand before you all the days of your life. Just as I have been with Moses, I will be with you. I will not fail you or forsake you. Be strong and courageous, for you shall give this people possession of the land which I swore to their fathers to give them. Only be strong and very courageous. Be careful to do all according to all the law which Moses my servant commanded you. Do not turn from it to the right nor to the left, so that you may have success wherever you go. This book of the law shall not depart from your mouth, but you shall meditate on it day and night, so that you may be careful to do all according to all that is written in it. For then you will make your way prosperous, and then you will have success. Have I not commanded you? Be strong and courageous. Do not tremble or be dismayed, for the Lord your God is with you wherever you go. Then Joshua commanded the officers of the people, saying, pass through the midst of the camp and command the people, saying, prepare provisions for yourselves, for within 3 days you are to cross this Jordan to go in to possess the land which the Lord your God is giving you to possess it. To the Reubenites and to the Gadites and to the half the tribe of Manasseh, Joshua said, remember the word which Moses, the servant of the Lord, commanded you, saying, the Lord your God gives you rest and will give you this land. Your wives and your little ones and your cattle shall remain in the land which Moses gave you beyond the Jordan, but you shall cross over before your brothers in battle array. All of your valiant warriors shall help them until the Lord gives your brothers rest as he gives you. And they also possess the land which the Lord your God is giving them. Then you shall return to your own land and possess that which Moses, the servant of the Lord, gave you beyond the Jordan toward the sunrise. And they answered Joshua, all that you have commanded us, we will do, and wherever you send us, we will go. Just as we obeyed Moses in all things, we will obey you. May the Lord your God be with you as he was with Moses. I bet Joshua didn't find too much comfort in that. Just as we obeyed Moses, those people who continually disobeyed Moses. Anyway, anyone who rebels against your command and does not obey your words in all that you command him shall be put to death. Only be strong and courageous. And we know how the story unfolds from here. They cross the Jordan after a miracle, or with a miracle. They attack Jericho, which falls after another miracle. But wait, why Jericho? Why would they attack that city? Who told Joshua to attack that city first? We have no record in the Bible of God telling him to do so. And this illustrates what's missing in the first chapter of Joshua. God tells them to do a number of things, cross the Jordan, take the land, obey the law, be strong and courageous, but he gives no instructions about which city to attack first or which area to conquer first. There's no campaign plan. There's no battle plan for taking the land that God gives to Joshua. God gave Joshua the goal, occupy the land, but he did not tell him where to start and how to go about doing it. Some things God leaves to us to decide, even as we are following him. He expects us to prayerfully move forward with wisdom to accomplish the tasks he has set before us. But he doesn't necessarily instruct us how to do every single bit of it. So if we accept that as true, we are entitled to ask another question. Does God in the Bible give us any guidelines for moving forward, for accomplishing what he desires for us? If we have a life decision in front of us of anything, say what job to accept, where to move to, what does God want me to do with my life, does God give us any guidelines on how to make those choices and what to do with them? Well, here are five things God tells Joshua that we can use. There may be others. In fact, I'm sure that there are. Other scriptures add other elements to this, and we can refine them according to the context. But here are five that we can start with, all from the first chapter of Joshua. The first one, go out of your comfort zone. Go out of your comfort zone. You actually can see this in the example of Abraham as well. But we'll stick with Joshua. Joshua 1, verse 2. Moses, my servant, is dead. Now, therefore, arise, cross this Jordan, you and all this people, to the land which I am giving to them, to the sons of Israel. You have to leave your comfort zone. You have to choose and move. We cannot stay where we are and possess the good things that God has in store for us. And this takes courage. Four times, Joshua is told, three times by God and once by the people, be strong and very courageous, because it takes courage to leave our comfort zone. It takes courage to make a choice and move forward. Now, it doesn't have to be the right choice, I'll put that in quotes, because each choice is a step forward, because each time you make a choice, you grow and you learn from them. Take a look at Proverbs 24. Proverbs 24, we're going to read verses 30 through 34. But particularly, I'm going to concentrate on the last two verses, but I want to get the full context. Proverbs chapter 24, verse 30 through 34. So I passed by the field of the sluggard, and by the vineyard of the man lacking sense, and behold, it was completely overgrown with thistles. Its surface was covered with nettles, and its stone wall was broken down. When I saw, I reflected upon it. I looked, and I received instruction. A little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to rest, and then your poverty will come on you as a robber, and your want like an armed man. Choosing to stay put, choosing to stay where we are, is choosing poverty and want. That can apply financially, it can apply physically, health-wise, and it can also apply spiritually. We cannot just fold our hands and stay at rest where we are. God designed his creation to grow. What sort of trees do not grow? Dead ones don't grow. Sitting in our comfort zone is not the way to grow. We need to get up and cross the Jordan. When you know who you are and the values you hold, you have a firm foundation upon which to make, or from which to make decisions, and the choices you make are richer and more meaningful. The problems that Israel ran into were because they did not have the law written in their hearts. They didn't know who they were. They didn't hold those values. They saw it as an outside thing, decreeing what they can and cannot do in particular situations. We don't have that problem. Through the indwelling Holy Spirit, Christ is in us. God's way is a motivational force and a set of values that gives us a firm foundation from which we can make our decisions. This means that in some ways, desiring to make the right choice is a bit of a cop-out. If we're making a choice based upon an outside restriction or a dictate, we are making the same mistake that the children of Israel made. I want to make clear that obviously we desire to make godly choices. We desire to be in tune with God. So we're talking about a bit of balance here. And what I'm talking about is this extreme. How do I know if I'm choosing what God wants? Or I'm afraid of making a choice because I might choose something God didn't want and I might be in conflict with God. I would submit to you that those occasions are extremely rare in our lives, if they ever occur at all, because we have the indwelling of the Holy Spirit, because we have this foundation that and values that we hold, and it gives us a foundation from which to make choices. Now, of course, some choices are more painful than others, but that does not mean it was a wrong choice. After all, every circumstance is a chance for growth. After you survive an ill-advised choice and its consequences, which we'll see later on, you have grown. You're wiser, and you're better able to make other choices. So don't be afraid to make a choice and get out of your comfort zone. In the book Man's Search for Meaning, Holocaust survivor and psychiatrist Viktor Frankl states this: "Everything can be taken from a man but one thing, the last of the human freedoms, to choose one's attitude at any given set of circumstances, to choose one's own way. Every human being has the freedom to change at any instant." The point is this: not choosing is often worse than making a bad choice. Choice is uncomfortable. That's why God told Joshua to be strong and courageous. Here's a real world example. Let's say you're at work and you're the recipient of biased behavior by your boss, either based upon your sex or your race or your religion. Now you've got some choices to do, or choices to make, I should say. You can do nothing. You can just tough it out. You can quit and you can find a new job. Or you can use the laws and the rules of our time and our society to seek justified redress for what's happened to you. Like Paul, who used the Roman law to relieve his suffering, secure his release, enable the furthering of the gospel. He also used theological debate to cause confusion among his adversaries to further the gospel. The choice is ours. And I do not pretend that all these choices are easy, and of course they should be done as God instructs, i.e., let not this law depart from your mouth, as God tells Joshua. In other words, these choices need to be made prayerfully. But let us at least recognize that they are choices, and be strong and very courageous and cross the river. The second thing God gave to Joshua was a goal. He set a clear goal for him. I've entitled this "Go with Purpose." The first one was, forgot what the first one was, I'm sorry. The second one is "Go with Purpose." Proverbs 29 verse 18 is a good place to start for this one. Proverbs 29 verse 18, memory verse for many people. "Where there is no vision, the people perish, but he that keeps the law, happy is he." God understands that people need a goal. People need vision. He created us that way. If we look back in the first chapter of Joshua, verses 3 through 4, this is Joshua's goal. This is what God tells he and the people: "Every place on which the sole of your foot treads, I have given it to you, just as I spoke to Moses. From the wilderness and this Lebanon, even as far as the river Euphrates, and all the land of the Hittites, and as far as the great sea toward the setting of the sun, will be your territory." That's a pretty big slice of territory for those people. That's a pretty big goal. God clearly explained the goal: conquer the land, divide it up. It was clear, it was understandable. Yet it was also broad and strategic. How the land was to be conquered was not detailed. He didn't give him a list of cities. He didn't tell him, start in the north, move to the south, or start with the plains and move to the hills. He didn't do any of that. No list of what to do after they burned the cities. They conquered a city. Are they supposed to just leave it there? Now, some of them specifically he did, like Jericho, but others, there's nothing. Do they occupy the cities? Do they leave them there? Do they take over the farmlands? Not a lot of detail there. But it was a strategic goal, a broad, overarching goal. You know, you can find a lot on the internet about goal setting. I typed in "goal setting" on Google. In 0.79 seconds, I got 1.4 billion, with a B, responses. Or the little thing at the top said there are 1.4 billion things out there that say "goal setting." I thought, okay, that's pretty broad, goal setting. I mean, it could be talking about soccer goals, right? Or football goals, whatever, who knows? So I wrote "clear goals." Guess what? 1.4 billion again, with a B. 1.4 billion. Then I thought, well, let me focus a little bit more. "Power of goal setting," I typed in. 605 million responses in less than a second. 605 million responses. There's a lot of stuff out there about setting goals. It's widely acknowledged that a major key, and often the first key to success or self-improvement in anything, in any factor of life, is setting a goal. But self-improvement isn't the gospel, is it? Look at 1 Corinthians 9, verse 23 through 27. 1 Corinthians 9, verses 23 through 27. Paul is talking to the church at Corinth, a mixed group of mostly Gentiles, but a number of Jews as well. Corinth was known for all kinds of different activities, most of which were not pleasant. Very cosmopolitan city, let's put it that way, in the Roman world. Had been around for years. It was actually the first place, according to Greek legend, it was the first place that the Greeks learned writing and the arts of civilization. So Corinth was the center of Greek civilization in its history, if you will. In 1 Corinthians 9, chapter 9, verse 23 through 27, Paul says, "I do all things for the sake of the gospel, so that I might become a fellow partaker of it. Do you not know that those who run in a race all run, but only one receives the prize? Run in such a way that you may win. Everyone who competes in the games exercises self-control in all things. They then do it to receive a perishable wreath, but we an imperishable. Therefore, I run in such a way as not without aim. I box in such a way as not beating the air, but I discipline my body and make it my slave, so that after I have preached to others, I myself will not be disqualified." Paul tells us a number of things here. In verse 23, he says, everything he did was for the sake of the gospel. All things, he said. I think that includes self-improvement. I think that includes maybe looking for a new job. I think that includes, maybe I'm going to do this new thing with my life. All things for the sake of the gospel. It depends on why we're doing it and how we go about it. Paul says in verse 24, he runs to win. In other words, run with a goal in mind. He's not just running for exercise. He's got a purpose. Verse 26, he repeats that. He runs with an aim, with a goal. There's a connection between spiritual goals and personal well-being. Maybe it's better said this way. Pursuing the right spiritual goal, one that is really for the next life, can also have benefits in this life because it requires some of the same disciplines. Well, what do goals do for us? What do goals do for it? Again, I'm not going to try to go through all 1.4 billion responses that I got, but here's a couple things. They give us a sense of purpose. You know, you can't hit the target if you don't have a target. If you don't know what you're aiming for, whatever you're shooting, arrows, whatever, going to go anywhere. Okay? They help us overcome procrastination. If you've got a goal, you've got a reason to be doing things. Get up in the morning to do the next task. They help us hold ourselves accountable. They help us hold ourselves. We've got something to measure against. This is my goal. I'm halfway there. I know where I'm lacking. And they also help us measure our progress, which is motivational. You can see, hey, I've made it halfway already. This is great. I'm getting closer to my goal. And that makes it easier to accomplish the rest of the goal. So what is your goal? A new job? Starting a family? Getting a promotion, writing a book, learning a new skill, becoming more thankful or gracious or less, fill in the blank that you want to be less of. What is your goal? Did you write that goal down? Did you give it a time frame? Have you broken it down into steps? Go online. You can find all these kinds of things to do about your goals. The point is, God gave Joshua a clear and understandable goal. He wanted the children of Israel to have purpose. And when we're figuring out the things we're doing in our lives, it sure would be helpful if we had a purpose. We can put purpose in our lives in the same manner that God gave the Israelites purpose, setting a goal. The third thing he told Joshua is in Joshua 1, verses 7 and 8. Joshua 1, verses 7 and 8. I call this, go with God. Go with God. He didn't tell them what to conquer or in what order, but he did tell them to keep his commands close and obey his word. Verse 7, only be strong and very courageous. Be careful to do according to all the law which Moses, my servant, commanded you. Do not turn from it to the right or to the left, so that you may have success wherever you go. This book of the law shall not depart from your mouth, but you shall meditate on it day and night, so that you may be very careful to do according to all that is written in it. For then you will make your way prosperous, and then you will have success. Keep God close, is what he's saying. Keep God close. Go with God. In James chapter 4, verses 13 through 15, James chapter 4, verses 13 through 15 adds this. Come now, you who say, today or tomorrow we will go into such and such a town, we will spend a year there and trade and make a profit. Yet you do not know what tomorrow will bring. What is your life? For you are a mist that appears for a little time and then vanishes. Instead, you ought to say, if the Lord wills, we will live and do this or that. In other words, James is reminding us that we need to have God with us when we're making our plans. We need to have God close by. We need to keep him very close. Very soon after entering the land, Israel ran into trouble for two reasons. They disobeyed and they did not check in with God. They disobeyed and they didn't check in with God. We know the story of Jericho and how Achan took some of the spoil from the city in defiance of God's instructions. And as a result, 36 Israelites died in an attack on the city of Ai, a small city that they should have been easily been able to take. But the army of God fled. I wonder what would have happened if they had checked in with God first. If Joshua just said, hey, God, we took Jericho. I think we're going to go after Ai next. That's our plan. What do you think? I think God would have probably said, wait a second, something's going on here. Somebody took something. We need to get this figured out first before you go and do anything. Okay. Shortly after Ai, the men of Gibeon deceived the children of Israel into thinking that they were not inhabitants of the land, that they lived far away. So instead of destroying Gibeon, Israel made an alliance with them. Now, this second instance is, in my mind, understandable. I mean, all the signs pointed to the fact that the Gibeonites were from a long ways away. So it's natural for Israel to say, look, God told us to destroy the inhabitants of this land, but these people are from far away, so we'll go ahead and we'll make an alliance with them. And we're still keeping God's instructions by doing this. So, fine. And let's remember that God didn't punish Israel for that error. He let them know it was an error. But the point is this. Although we have established what God expects us to do, to make plans and decisions on our own, he still wants us to check in with him from time to time. He still wants us to check in with him from time to time. So let's say you've decided to buy a new home. You have a plan to save up for a down payment. You've taken this decision to God in prayer. You know what your parameters are, how much you can borrow, at what rate, etc., etc. At least for now, because it may take you a few years to save up that down payment. And by that time, the rates and the conditions and the offers will all have changed, etc. But life's like that. So time passes, and you're working on your goal. Circumstances change. And then, if you're a married couple, perhaps you find that the wife is pregnant. Or if you're single, perhaps a job opportunity comes up that is less pay, but offers the potential of greater long-term advantage, an opportunity for experiences in a new skill, for example. Should you change your plans? Should that money now that you're saving up for the down payment, should that now go into a 529 plan for your child's education? Should you delay the house buying plan? You decide, but do so with God's help. Let him know what you're thinking. In fact, you will find that if you've been talking to him all along about your situation, checking in with him will be a lot easier. Proverbs 16, verse 3. Here's some proverbs and other passages from Scripture about our plans and God's reaction to them, or relationship to them. Proverbs 16, verse 3. Commit your works to the Lord, and your plans will be established. Check in with God. Ask him about it. Proverbs 16, verse 9. The mind of man plans his way, but the Lord directs his steps. You've got a good plan. You even think you know how you're getting there. Okay, be flexible. Maybe God's got a different way for you to get there, a slight variation on that plan. Psalm 20, verse 4. May he grant you your heart's desire and fulfill all your counsel. A lovely psalm, a lovely wish. And in Jeremiah 29, verse 11, God says, for I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord, plans for welfare and not for calamity, to give you a future and a hope. And I remind you, this is in the book of Jeremiah, which is all about how he's going to punish them for all the terrible things they've done. And at the end of it, he says, well, actually, it's in the middle of it, because Jeremiah is a very long book. But at the end of a certain passage, he says, I know the plans I have for you. They're plans for welfare and not for calamity. I'm going to give you a future of hope. And then Proverbs 15, verse 22. Without consultation, plans are frustrated, but with many counselors, they succeed. Don't make your plans in a vacuum. Seek advice from God. Seek advice from other people who have experience in whatever it is that you're planning, and surround yourself with counselors. And I don't mean experts when I say counselors. Surround yourselves with people who know you, who can lift you up or say, hey, wait a second. I know your personality. You sure you want to go that way? Because, you know, that requires these, or that relies on, this path relies on these personality traits, and maybe you're not quite there yet. Or this is something that you may need to help you along. So not just experts in the technical side of what you're doing, but experts in you, people who interact with you, your family, etc. But always remember, they're your own plans and your choices, and we need to own those things. Oh, and one last thought that just came to mind. Because you're surrounding yourself with counselors, if you ever find you're the smartest one in the room, you're in the wrong room. We should be surrounding ourselves with people who know more than we do, who are smarter, who have more experience. Point number four that God gave to Joshua. Be prepared for obstacles. I call this one, go fearlessly. Go fearlessly. Because an obstacle does not mean God is not backing your decision or your choice. Don't let obstacles keep you home. Proverbs 22, verse 13. This is the classic reaction to an obstacle. Solomon tells us that the sluggard says, there's a lion outside. I will be killed in the streets. And therefore, he never goes outside of his house, is the point. There's an obstacle. I can't overcome it. What did the children of Israel do shortly after crossing the Red Sea? They wanted to go back to Egypt. They wanted to go back to slavery. We see that in Exodus 16. What did they want to go back to? It's described in Exodus 1, verses 13 through 16. This is what they wanted to go back to. Although they remembered it slightly differently, this is what their life was. Exodus 1, verses 13 through 16. The Egyptians compelled the sons of Israel to labor rigorously, and they made their lives bitter with hard labor in mortar and bricks and all kinds of labor in the field, all their labors which were rigorously imposed upon them. Then the king of Egypt spoke to the Hebrew midwives, one of whom was named Shiphrah and the other was named Puah. And he said, when you are helping the Hebrew women to give birth and see them upon the birth stool, if it is a son, then you shall put him to death. But if it's a daughter, then she shall live. That's what they wanted to go back to. Bitter toil, murder, and mayhem. And yet, they remembered it slightly differently. They wanted to go back. So let's not fool ourselves that we would never want to go back to our slavery to sin. The attraction of slavery is present because it is easy. Slavery to sin is easy, even though it may kill our children. And this sinful world is full of young lives destroyed, make no mistake about it. Destroyed by drugs, by broken families, by murder, by violence, by despair, by suicide. Contrast this attitude with David. He had a big obstacle once by the name of Goliath. We see this in 1 Samuel 17, verse 40. At least the part I want to focus on anyway. 1 Samuel 17, verse 40. We know the story of Goliath. Big guy, real tough, good fighter. Challenges the children of Israel for 40 days. Nobody comes out to fight him. He says, come out and fight me, you cowards. And for 40 days, the Israelites prove him correct. They are cowards. Even the king will not go out and fight against Goliath. But David does. A relatively young shepherd boy uses his own experiences. And in 1 Samuel 17:40, we see this little tidbit about David. He took his stick in his hand and chose for himself 5 smooth stones from the brook, and he put them in the shepherd's bag, which he had, even in his pouch. And his sling was in his hand, and he approached the Philistine. So he had 5 rocks, a bag, a stick, and a sling. Why 5? Why did he pick up 5 rocks? Well, probably in case he missed with the first one. That would seem the obvious answer. Or maybe he missed with the second one. Or maybe it bounced off Goliath's armor. Or he had to throw another one. He was prepared. He was not going to let this obstacle stop him. I had a friend, excuse me. I had a friend in college from British Columbia. and he was a logger for part of his life. And he told me a story once about he was going out with the logging crews, and they were going to go cut timber wherever it was, and they were dropping him off because there was this small patch of timber. There's enough for one person to cut. You could spend, you know, half the day cutting. They'd pick him up for lunch and take him back to the camp. But it really wasn't enough for a full team, and he was a big guy. So, okay, we're going to drop you off here. We're going to have you cut that timber. And so he started cutting those trees down. The only problem was, this was Canada. Well, Canada. That's not a problem. That's not what I meant. it was in Canada, British Columbia. And it was in moose rutting season. And if you know what moose are, they're very large animals. And when they're in rut, they are very mean. And there just so happened that there was a moose in this patch of trees. And it kept trying to get him. And he said he kept trying to run away from this moose. He'd start cutting a tree and the moose would show up. And then he'd have to move away from it. He'd start cutting another tree and the moose would show up. And no matter where he went, this big male moose was following him, trying to get him. So he decided that the only thing he could do was cut down a tree and drop it on the moose and kill it, because that's the only way he was going to get out of this, because he can't run from the moose forever, because they're faster and they're eventually going to get him. So he starts cutting. And of course, he told me this story in a very Canadian way, so it was a lot more entertaining and funny. But he started cutting, and he took that first tree, and of course, he missed the moose. And the next tree, and he missed the moose. And the next tree, and he didn't tell me how many trees there, but he said he was on his last tree, and he was realizing that this was not working. Something was not going right here. And on his last tree, he got the moose and was able to kill it, and therefore save his own life, because the moose would have probably killed him too if he hadn't done that. So anyway, he was not going to let that obstacle, the first tree, stop him, or the second tree, or the third tree, or the tenth tree, okay? He kept going until he had that obstacle overcome. Here's the thing about obstacles. Running into them, even failing the first time or second or third time, teaches you one more way how not to overcome it. Initial failure can lead to success. And we see this in the conquest of Ai. What happens the first time? The children of Israel go, they get chased away, 36 Israelites die, they all run off. God goes back, or God corrects the problem that was at the core of that, sends them back, and then he tells them, hey, do it the same way you just did it. Put some guys hiding in the back of the city, the other side of the city, go up, and then pretend to run away, and they'll all come out. And sure enough, that's what happened. The Israelites went up, they pretended to retreat, all the inhabitants of the city went chasing after them, they ran down a few miles, whatever direction, away from the city, and then the ambush from behind came in while the city gates were open, walked into the city, torched it, the army saw it from behind, and scattered. So that very same action that was indicative of the problem they had turned out to be the solution the next time they overcame that obstacle. The fifth and last point that God gives Joshua: gather the resources and get moving. Gather the resources and get moving, or go prepared, if you will. Joshua 1, verses 10 and 11. Joshua 1, verses 10 and 11. Then Joshua commanded the officers of the people, saying, pass through the midst of the camp and command the people, saying, prepare provisions for yourselves, for within 3 days you are to cross this Jordan to go in to possess the land which the Lord your God is giving you to possess it. In 3 days, gather these provisions together. Proverbs 24, verses 26 and 27 echoes this idea. I'm just going to read verse 27. Prepare your work outside and make it ready for yourself in the field. Afterwards, build your house. Gather the resources first. Make sure you've secured those. Anything worth doing is going to cost something. It may cost time, it may cost money, it may cost commitment and sacrifice. Jesus reminds us of this in Luke chapter 14, where he's speaking primarily, of course, of the cost of discipleship, but the principles apply to other parts of our lives. And he says this: whoever does not carry his own cross and come after me cannot be my disciple. For which one of you, when he wants to build a tower, does not first sit down and calculate the cost to see if he has enough to complete it? Getting the resources, Jesus is telling people. Otherwise, when he has laid the foundation and is not able to finish, all who observe it begin to ridicule him, saying, this man began to build and was not able to finish. Or what king, when he sets out to meet another king in battle, will not first sit down and consider whether he is strong enough with 10,000 men to encounter the one coming against him with 20,000? Or else while the other is still far away, he sends a delegation and asks for terms of peace. Go prepared. Get the resources. One way we can do this is to connect our resources to the goal. What will it cost to complete this goal? How long? How will I get the resources I don't have? When will I need them? Are you planning a career change? Are you looking forward to retirement? Do you want to move to a different house, to a different city? Is your goal to be healthier? What resources does that require? What sort of training or exercise? How are you going to get it? What sort of time commitment will it take? Maybe you can do it at home, but maybe having a gym membership is what you need to get you out of your rut. I'm that second kind of person. I've got stuff at home. I don't use it that often. My kids use it more than I do, and good for them. I would be probably better off with a gym membership, because then I'd be forced to go do it, right? What are your resources? Where are they? We need to be able to count and measure the cost of our choices and use those resources to move forward. Going boldly before the throne of God is a vital part of our Christian behavior. It's something I'm sure we all do. And in addition to the spiritual implications, there's a life application element to it as well. Think of it this way. You're going before the greatest throne room in the entire universe. Greater than David's throne when Nathan the prophet had to tell him he was sinning. And imagine the courage that took. You walk into the throne room of the king, he can just snap his fingers and somebody will take you out and fall upon you and you're dead. Okay? So imagine the courage it took for Nathan the prophet to go into him and say, hey, you're sinning. Greater even than the throne of Persia when Esther the king went before the empire of all the Persians with her request. You've gone to a greater throne room than that. And if you can stride boldly into that space, then wow, what are physical obstacles to you? If we can go boldly before God with our petition, then we have the moxie to handle that petition. We have what it takes to go out of our comfort zone, to go with purpose, go with God, go fearlessly, and go prepared. So, my dear brethren, go boldly.